Amory and 107.5 FM W298DK Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. A surprise in Santa Fe, New Mexico that ends the manslaughter case against Alec Baldwin in the fatal movie set shooting of a crew member in the Western Rust. ABC's Mola Lenghi in Santa Fe.
After hours of tense testimony, the judge dismissing this case.
Your motion to dismiss with prejudice is granted.
Meaning the state cannot refile these charges against Alec Baldwin. So after nearly 3 years and, of course, a deadly tragedy, Alec Baldwin finally free from this legal ordeal.
President Biden making fun of his verbal flubs and saying the news media ought to also report any mistakes Donald Trump makes.
But people would rather talk about how I mix up names. I guess they don't remember that Trump called Nikki Haley Nancy Pelosi.
The president at an overflow rally at a Detroit high school gym tonight. Colorado reporting 3 presumptive human cases of bird flu in poultry workers. Samples have been sent to the CDC to confirm. This is ABC News.
I'm James Kelly with WLAK News. Your news roundup in quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WLAK website at lakeair.radio.
Civic Media News, I'm Ella Saff. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. COVID cases are rising in central Wisconsin, but doctors say they're not alarmed. Melissa Kay explains.
Dr. Stephen Phillipson is an MD with Aspirus.
The good news about that is community transmission may be higher, but it's not impacting hospitalization, which means COVID is reverting to more of a disease like influenza, which can be deadly for some people, but not as deadly as it was when the pandemic first started.
Phillipson said that it's good to be aware and use protective measures when necessary. I'm Melissa Kay.
The Republican National Convention kicks off on Monday in Milwaukee. The 4-day convention is expected to attract more than 50,000 visitors to Wisconsin's largest city. Republican Party leaders expect Donald Trump will make an appearance to accept the presidential nomination. Civic Media News will be at the convention, bringing you coverage throughout the week, over the air, and online. And that's what you need to know. I'm Ella Saff, and this is Civic Media News.
Matt and Air on Air.
Project 2025, it's going to drastically change democracy. We did have a text from Lynn. She says, well, Jane and Greg, you are scaring me. I'm not trying to scare you, Lynn. I'm trying to make sure everybody understands what this would do. And it's scary, especially when we're talking about firing more than 50,000 civil employees and replace them with people who will just do what Trump wants. So Jared Kushner apparently is qualified to do everything.
Matt and Air on Air. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. This is Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Let's start off with a little bit of history. Doubt anybody's still alive from this era, but the year was 1917. And about 2,000 vigilantes under the umbrella of the Citizens Protective League. They decided that, you know, those workers that were demanding better wages, hours, conditions, you know, those people who are demanding safer working conditions, who wanted to get paid, better than poverty wages, demand safe working conditions, more people working, less blasting, all kinds of things that would make life better. The vigilantes, not thrilled, and rounded up about 1,000 striking workers. Put them onto cattle cars that were provided by the El Paso and Southwestern Railroad and shipped to the middle of nowhere. This would be the Bisbee deportation. Maybe you've heard of it. Probably didn't. It's where you had the citizens, you know, people hired by the coal companies and the copper companies, the mining companies, who are there saying, hey, we don't want to pay wages. We don't want to share. You know, because after all, the war is going on. So, you know, the excuse for you is, you know, national security. We need you to get in there and mine as close to free as possible because we want to keep making money. And the reason I bring this up is understand our history has these kind of things. where, you know, the workers were saying, hey, we want better wages, hours, conditions. We want better opportunities. We want to be treated better. We want a little dignity, a little respect. And we're going to demand it. And we're going to band together, collectively, in solidarity, to fight for these things in one of those union things. And the employers are like, well, no. And we're going to use the power of the gun. We're going to use the power of a angry mob. We're going to use racism and all of the things that are meant to divide us, because some of these people were of Mexican descent. Some were German. Some were, who knows? Some of them, oddly enough, were Americans, people who just needed jobs, but they didn't care. Striking workers out to the middle of nowhere, somewhere in Mexico, they just out. And this is our history. This is our history. And you go, but Rick, why are you telling me this? Why are you telling me that, you know, they loaded all these people onto cattle cars and drove them like 200 miles, you know, like for like 16 hours and, you know, in the desert with no food or water or anything, you know, crammed. Why? Why'd they do that? Because they could. And why does it matter now? Well, have you ever heard that saying that sometimes history repeats itself? I'm concerned. I'm concerned. And this is why elections have consequences. I'm concerned because, you know, I was reading a New York Times story about the guy who is the Nassau County executive, a guy named Bruce Blakeman. He is a Republican. He is a Trump supporter. He's all of that. He's all of that. Evidently, back in March, he said to residents, hey, if you got gun permits and you want to become a provisional emergency special deputy sheriff, you know, part of the Citizens Protective League, sign up. And for $150 a day, if we call you into action, we will pay you $150 a day of tax dollars to do whatever it is that we want you to do. So whatever we decide is an emergency, you know, like striking workers, you know, like people marching in protest of, I don't know, a provisional emergency special deputy sheriff militia. I don't know. Maybe people would be against this. Understand, our history is littered with wealthy people funding politicians and others to create these front groups, these thug groups, who then go after poor and working people, keep them in line. So when I saw this story, I'm going, well, there's one part of it. The other part of it is, you may know, Trump has already said that let me quote House Speaker Mike Johnson, who on Monday gave a little spiel at the Hudson Institute, an extremely conservative, I hate to say think tank, but one of those. And he said, quote, talking about immigration, he said, we'll be dealing with this for decades to come. President Trump has said we want to start the largest deportation effort ever in history. He says it's needed. We need to find all these dangerous criminals and send them over the border. And you go, have we seen this movie before?
Yes, we have.
It's the very same people who will be attending the Republican National Convention. It's the people whose policies are to keep workers' wages down. It's the people's policies are to destroy collective bargaining. It's the people whose policies are to, you know, want to go with a big giant bus and round people up. Americans, maybe they get out of it. And the reality is this is one of those moments where we decide what kind of country we are. Who are we in this moment? Are we a country that's going to be willing to go, yeah, let's round up people. Let's kick in their doors at the point of a gun and put them on a train car. I mean, stop and think about it. You know, 1917 was a long time ago. There were fewer rules protecting people's rights, and well, there may have been one actual sheriff, and then these vigilantes. And we've seen the stories of towns burning. We've seen the stories of just horrific things being done in the name of saving capital, being done in the name of protecting big business. Do you think that this Bisbee deportation, do you think this had anything to do with, oh, we care about the people living in our neighborhoods? Oh, they may commit a crime. No, this is about money. Pure and simple. And when you've got a Republican Party who's not just insinuating they're going to get a giant bus and ship people out and creating special. And I love the name. I gotta give credit. A Provisional Emergency Special Deputy Department. You got a question. What are we doing in this country? What are we fighting for? Me, I'm a huge supporter of the labor movement. I would have been, I guarantee it, back in 1917, I'd have been one of those people on the train. Because I would have been saying, you know what? We earn better. The labor that we do should be compensated. That's why it distresses me when I see my union's president, Sean O'Brien, going to be speaking at the RNC. And I talked about this yesterday on the program. Got a lot of very interesting feedback. The kind of feedback that makes me go, I'm on the right side of history. There was no one who stepped forth and said, that's a great idea. We should align the unions with the fascists who have destroyed all of the safety net that we used to know, that have gone after collective bargaining rights and have gone after the ability for people to fight for better wages, hours, conditions, all that stuff, created an environment where the legal systems stacked against them, the administrative state system would be stacked against them. You know, kind of like being rounded up in the early morning hours and put on a boxcar and shipped out of town. And my union's president is going to speak there. Now, as I said yesterday, I don't know what he's going to say. I don't know what he can say. I don't know if he thinks he can be persuasive, or if they're going to listen, or if they're going to, as I said, treat him as the show pony that I think he will be and ride him to the election, to where they will then deport him right out. But I look at this, and the responses that I got were of great concern, because we're heading into this divide moment. And I had someone say to me, have you ever thought that your union is going to be the anti-woke union, the one who's okay with, you know, going after those people, just as long as we get ours? And I don't know. I don't know what's in Sean O'Brien's mind. I don't know what is in his heart. I can only say that I'm not thrilled with the idea of giving my drive contribution money to the RNC or Republicans who have done their full hearty best to make it harder for me and people like me to make a living. I don't know what the end game here is. But I know it's not good, because we know what Republicans are going to do in this moment. They've told us. Donald Trump has been very clear. He believes in right to work. They will continue to push the whole no rights at work agenda. Now, it's been told to me that you know, Sean O'Brien, you know, spoke with Josh Hawley, and that evidently Josh Hawley just didn't know what right to work laws were. And, you know, there was an explanation that went on. Will there be a come to Jesus moment where he goes, I was wrong? Will there be an epiphany, a moment of clarity? No. These folks are avowed anti-union people. And the thing is, look, I want to be able to work with Republicans. I do. I do want to dig up some of the Eisenhower, the good socialist Republicans like Eisenhower, who once said in a letter to his brother, Edgar, if anyone, you know, were to come out against, you know, Social Security or unemployment or labor laws or the farm bill, they wouldn't be heard from in our history. He said there are a number of millionaires and business people who want these things, but their numbers are negligible and they are stupid. The sad reality is stupid has taken over the Republican Party and a good portion of the Democratic Party in some instances. But right now, in this moment, what Joe Biden has set us on the course for and when I assume the next person and I demand the next person to pick up, workers' rights will be at the center of it. You know, yesterday on the program, we talked about a number of things that happened under the Trump administration. No one could point to me something that was positive for workers. Nothing. We could spend the next hour talking about things that I think went well during the last 3.5, almost 4 years. The fact that Biden has done some really transformational things. So I'm going to be looking forward to the speech. I can't wait to see what my general president of my Teamsters union has to say. I will be watching with both ears and eyes and a whole nine yards, because I have no idea what it is that this is. Now, could be an endorsement. I doubt it. Could be. Could be this full-throated, you know, Donald's our guy. I don't think that's going to happen, but we will see. I do want to hear your thoughts, though, because some of the ones that I've gotten really have been fantastic, and thank you. In this moment, quite frankly, I needed the input. I needed the benefit of there are people who think this is important. Because if we don't learn from history, we're going to repeat it. And if we don't have champions who are going to stand up and fight for working people, if we don't have people who are going to, well, take on those who want to destroy us, I don't know what we're going to do. Again, I'm going to hold my final judgment on the speech until we see it. But I think even going, even the mere thought of going, legitimizes Trump and the Republicans. And sad reality is, talking to several Teamster members, they think an endorsement has already been had just by him being there. Going to take a quick break. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So you may remember when Trump was in Las Vegas, he was speaking to a rally there, said something about eliminating tips, taxes for tips. How did it go? He says he's going to eliminate taxes on tips for restaurant workers and hospitality workers and anyone else relying on tips. He said, no more taxes on tips. And immediately I got a bunch of emails from people going, hey, this is a stroke of genius, because the Republicans supposedly are the party of low taxes. Another email said it was a great incentive to get Americans back to work because we're lazy, evidently. Another one said, it's about time. This is what you talk about all the time. This is returning reward to work. Another person said, this is about dignity of work. And Trump is making work great again. Is that what he's doing? Or is this just a campaign ploy? I'm here to share some thoughts on what this means, what it'll do, and is this the greatest thing since sliced bread? I've asked our good friend Saru Yaraman to come talk with us. Saru is the president of One Fair Wage. Their website, onefairwage.org. Saru, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So, thoughts on the grand proposal of eliminating taxes on tipped workers?
So, look, I will give Trump credit that he is listening to and seeing the polling that shows that for every group, every poll I've seen of working people, people of color, women, young people, cost of living, inflation, and the economy, kitchen table economics are the absolute top issues everybody's saying are most important to them. And so he is clearly pandering to people seeing that that is most important. But this is not the right solution, let's be clear, because it is true that workers face a lot of issues with their taxes because tips are messy and really difficult to account for. The IRS does weird things with tips where they assume that you've earned a certain amount of tips and tax you on them, whether you've actually earned that or not in tips. All of that is important. But here's the bottom line. Tipped workers still earn a federal minimum wage in the United States of America of $2.13 an hour. And the real problem that we hear workers talking about all the time is that their wages are just too low. And living off of tips is completely unpredictable. You get a lot of tips one evening and nothing the next day. There's a hurricane, there's a blizzard, there's a hot moment like now when people don't go out to eat. And you're screwed. You can't pay the rent. Your rent and your bills don't go up and down, but your tips fluctuate every day, every hour, every season, every shift. And bottom line, anything to do with taxation is a once a year issue. If you were to get rid of taxation on tips, that might help tipped workers at one point of the year. It's called spring when our taxes are due. But the rest of the year, you're paying rent, you're paying bills, you're feeding your kids, you're trying to keep a roof over your head. That getting rid of taxes on tips doesn't help you in September or February or August when you're struggling to make ends meet. And so what workers really need and want above all else is a living wage from their boss, with tips being on top of that rather than instead of the wage as they are right now. And if I were to hear Trump talking about that, great, but he's not. He's talking about one simple and frankly, not that helpful idea of just getting rid of taxation on tips, which doesn't solve the fundamental problem of how much people earn every day, every week to cover the cost of goods.
No, absolutely. And the thing is this, he's talking about federal taxes, and so not all taxes, because you can only control the federal side. But if I remember another presidential candidate, sometime around 2012, when he was speaking to a bunch of donors, said that 47% of people don't pay federal taxes. How many of that 47% of the people are the ones that are working for tips? So it seems to me, and I got to be honest, I don't have the actual number, but it seems like a good number of tipped employees would be in that 47%. So I don't know how much help this actually is at all.
So many tipped workers don't even earn enough to clear the poverty line. And there's already something called the earned income tax credit, which a lot of low-income workers already get, which is that they don't pay taxes. They actually get a credit from the government because they're not earning enough to pay taxes. So, this is a nice thought. And I do wish Democrats would also hear and see that people are dealing with the cost of living and address that issue. But I wish everybody would understand, to address the cost of living, what people really need and want is a living wage with tips on top, not just a one-time reprieve from taxes.
No, I'm right there with you. We should be eliminating the tipped, that subcategory completely. But again, you brought up the earned income tax credit, something I've advocated raising so that families can put food on the table as a way to deal with inflation. But, I don't give Trump really credit for this, because I view this as another one of those campaign pledges that probably not going to happen, because it would be really difficult to do, especially since you'd have to kind of get it through Congress. But I see this as kind of a Trojan horse into the argument of, we need to expand Trump's tax credits from 2017.
I'm not giving him credit for actually accomplishing it. I don't think he could get it done. There've been already a lot of pushback from other Republicans saying they don't agree with it. They're fine with tax cuts for the wealthy, but they don't want to give it to anybody else. So I'm not saying I give him credit for getting it done. The only thing I give him credit for is seeing that dealing with the cost of living is the number one issue on people's minds.
Right.
All I'm saying is that I'm so looking forward to the moment when Democrats also see that as a top issue and address it, because I know when they do, they'll be talking about what people really need, which is raising wages. I mean, Biden ran on a platform of $15 an hour plus tips in 2020, and that's what we're waiting for him to talk about this year too.
No, look, the emails I got from people saying, and I say this all the time, you know, we need to return reward to work. You know, you need to have that incentive to be able to support yourself and the positive, you know, self-image that comes with that, all the good stuff that work brings. The reward being able to support yourself, keeping a roof over your head, food on the table, clothes on your kids' back, that's important stuff. Now, you guys are working on this, ending the tip wage across the country, and I know you've had a lot of great success. Anything coming up in this election cycle or soon?
Absolutely. Yeah, really exciting news that Michigan is, I think, any day now going to become the 8th state to end the subminimum wage for tipped workers. First state east of the Mississippi to provide restaurant workers with a full living wage with tips on top. The issue's on the ballot in Massachusetts. It will be on the ballot in Ohio next year. It is moving in a number of states across the country legislatively, Illinois, New York, Connecticut, Maryland. It's moving as a bill in the city of Baltimore. There's so much momentum because, to all your points around reward for work, this is how we get people back to work. If you actually ask workers, and we did, we surveyed 300,000 restaurant workers, why were they leaving the industry and what would make them come back? Number one thing they said is a full living wage with tips on top. It wasn't get rid of taxes. It was, I need a full living wage with tips on top. Most workers said that's the only thing that would make me come back and work in restaurants.
Now,
and that's why the restaurant industry has been facing such a terrible staffing crisis, because nobody can afford to work for these wages.
No, you see it all over the place. So is that a matter of increasing the minimum wage, doing away with the tipped minimum wage? But is this, you know, raising the minimum wage? Is this local ordinances like out in California where, you know, fast food workers are now making $20 an hour? You know, where would be the policies that you would advocate for?
So, like I said, we have statewide legislation moving in Michigan. We have a statewide ballot measure moving in Massachusetts. We have a statewide ballot measure moving in Ohio, a city bill moving in Baltimore, and statewide legislation moving in New York and Illinois and Connecticut and a bunch of other places. So these are happening at the state level mostly. There's some city fights, but it's mostly happening at the state level because nothing's moving in Congress right now. And so really it's all about the states getting this done, and I know they can.
No, most certainly. I mean, I don't know if you've paid attention to Congress, but they don't seem to be able to get much done.
No.
So, you know, addressing the needs of average everyday working people, not really high on their agenda, which I got to tell you, I'm hoping at some point we as voters start demanding that instead of all of the divisive stuff, the outrage candy that we've fed.
That's right.
If we're going to be outraged, we should be outraged that there are people who are working for a living who can't afford to live.
That's right. We should be outraged that there's even such a thing as a $2.13 subminimum wage. That's ridiculous in 2024. Frankly, it's ridiculous. $7 is the federal minimum wage. That's ridiculous in 2024. If you look at the cheapest county in the United States of America, it's McClellan, Texas. And right now, if you look at the MIT living wage calculator, McClellan, Texas, one person without any kids needs something like $18 or $19 an hour to survive, just to cover the basics. But most places across the country, it's $20 or higher. So these wages of 2 and 7 and 10 and 12, they're just not anywhere near what we need to truly meet the cost of living.
So what is that number? I mean, I get this a lot. I mean, like I said, California, the fast food workers are making $20 an hour. And boy, all I've heard is complaints and whining and complaining that, you know, business can't do it. They're going to raise prices. What do you say to that? I mean, if we give these tipped workers, you know, a living wage, if we have the audacity to say that their work should be valued, it's going to put the restaurants out of business, Saru.
No, actually, the states that have provided a living wage to workers with tips on top, like California, have higher restaurant sales, job growth rates, tipping averages than the rest of the country. And you don't have to take it from me. The CFO of Denny's was caught red-handed telling shareholders in an analyst call in 2021 that, in fact, paying people 15-plus tips resulted in Denny's California growing faster than Denny's in any other state in the United States. Why? He said, when we pay our people more at Denny's, guess what they do? They bring their families to eat at Denny's. Guest receipts are higher. Everybody does better. The company grows faster. So they have admitted it. All of the chains are growing faster in California than any other state. We have higher wages in California than any other state. The states with higher wages do better because workers do better. When workers do better, everybody does better.
It seems simple. If only we could get our elected leaders to figure that out. But Saru, I appreciate. Go ahead.
No. I was just going to, you were saying, what is the number now? I'm looking now at the MIT Living Wage Calculator. Again, for the cheapest county in the United States, it's 19 minimum, even if you don't have any kids. If you have one kid, it's $32 in the cheapest county. And that's just to cover rent and transportation and housing. It's not to take your kids to Disney World. It is just to cover the basic necessities. And so we need wages that are closer to that cost of living. And that's what workers are demanding right now.
There you go. Saru Yaraman, I appreciate you taking time for us. Hope folks will check out the website, onefairwage.org. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Good stuff. I want to hear your thoughts. Should this be the issue? Shouldn't this be what we're fighting over? Better wages, hours, conditions, opportunities. The fact that we still have $2.13, I have no idea how you exist on that, which is why, not surprising, people are running away from it. Quick break, right back.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK, Amory's home for Up North News Radio.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Partly cloudy, warm, and muggy tonight with a low only in the upper 60s. For the weekend, partly sunny, a few storms, some could be strong, hot and humid with highs upper 80s to 90. After another warm day Monday and a chance of storms, temperatures cool considerably, 70s for highs for the rest of next week. Right now it's 73.
The Todd Alma Show.
Andrew Hahn, he is a data journalist, and he maps out in this article what makes Wisconsin great. 96% of Wisconsinites live within 30 minutes of Quick Trip.
Wisconsin is one of those places that has a cultural identity that's unique to this place. And when we tell stories like this, it reminds people that we all come from this place and we all share a goal genuinely of trying to make this state a better place.
The Todd Alma Show. Weekdays noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So again, going to be talking about China, China, China. I know Trump has been on this, talking about the China shock and his plan on how he's going to take on China. And look, some of it, not a bad idea. And this is where I know my left friends are going to lose their mind. I know my red hat friends are going to be all happy. Look, I'm a protectionist. When I leave my house, lock the door. Not an isolationist. There's no moat around my house. But I do think we should be talking about how we protect domestic industries, how we protect ourselves for national security. Now, Trump's plan across the board, 10% on all imports, that tariff there, and 60% on everything from China. And here to share some thoughts on, is this a smart move to everything you see being a nail if all you got is a hammer? That's why I've asked Ryan Mulholland to come talk with us. He's a senior fellow there at the Center for American Progress. AmericanProgress.org, the website. Ryan, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick. Great to be here. As I say in radio, long-time listener, first-time caller.
I appreciate that. So I see this plan that Trump's got, and I got to tell you, I'm a tariff guy. I think we should be looking at using tariffs much more aggressively to protect our domestic industries, because I'm a big fan of domestic production for domestic consumption. But is this kind of too broad, maybe? Is this kind of the idea of if you got a hammer, everything's a nail?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, listen, so yeah, I'm with you on sort of smart, targeted tariffs being a tool in the arsenal, right? You know, we're trying to create working class jobs. We're trying to rebuild our industrial competitiveness. We're trying to bring prosperity back to middle America, right? And so you want all the tools that you can deploy towards that end. Tariffs, I think, are certainly one of them. But you want to do it in a sort of smart, calibrated, targeted way. A 10% across the board tariff, you know, it's a tariff on adversaries and allies alike. You know, that doesn't seem like the greatest way forward. Particularly when, you know, you want to work with partners and allies to try to, you know, de-risk our supply chains away from China. You know, on the one hand, you can look at kind of the economic impact. We've done some work sort of looking at, you know, a 10% across the board tariff would be about a $1,500 tax on the average American family. If you take Trump's, like, you know, 60% tariff on China, that goes up to a 2,500 a year. But I think the bigger story is, you know, one side has sort of a history of kind of using all the tools to create real, you know, manufacturing job growth and attracting investment into this sector. And the other side had 4 years and largely failed to. And so, you know, this is the first, frankly, election in a long time, I think since Teddy Roosevelt ran for president, where you have a sitting president running against a former president, right? So you can sort of compare two records. And when it comes to who's better at sort of creating working class jobs, it's pretty clear that the Biden team has the upper hand.
Well, it's clear to me that the Trump years were disastrous for working people, even though the corporate controlled media is framing all the inflation. It's all Joe Biden's fault. No, not corporate greed plays a big part of that. But what do you say to the person who goes, look, because you said a moment ago, you know, Trump's tariff is on adversaries and allies alike. What do you say to the people who go, look, you know, if you just go after China, if you just go after, you know, our adversaries, aren't you starting another kind of a Cold War? And I think there's some validity to that question. Is that a problem?
Like anything, I think there's probably some truth in it for sure. And, you know, we're talking in a matter of degrees, right? I mean, look at, say, you know, solar panels. We make like 2% of the world's solar panels. I think there's plenty of room for us to make a whole lot more and our partners and allies to make a whole lot more too. Same with semiconductors. You know, we've invested, you know, billions of dollars in rebuilding a semiconductor industry. Obviously, that's good for economic and national security, but nobody's talking about making 100%. I think Secretary Raimondo talks about 20%. Of the world semiconductors. Obviously a ton of room there for partners and allies to do the same, right? So this is not a US versus the world. This is us kind of reorienting global supply chains to make sure that we make more things in the US, but also that our partners have room to grow as well.
Yeah, you know, I often bring up, there's a bridge in Trenton, New Jersey. I don't know if you've ever seen it. I forget the number, but on the side of it, it's got Trenton makes the world takes. The idea of that era was, you know, they made stuff, they manufactured stuff. We were the leader in manufactured goods for, you know, for decades. And I don't say we lost it, we gave it away. We know exactly where it is. It's in China. And we did this by bad policy. We did this by training consumers to look for the cheapest product instead of what is, probably the best product. But I look at this as an opportunity to kind of re-educate us on, you know, why we need a strong manufacturing base, you know, maybe having products that don't have planned obsolescence as the front of the product. Maybe an education process now is a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, listen, clearly China has had a very kind of negative impact on manufacturing in this country, right? They're not market, their predatory practices have certainly contributed to a hollowing out of our working class industrial base, correct? But in addition to that, there's also been really bad policy decisions made in this country over the last 30 or 40 years, right? When you're committed to sort of trickle down neoliberal economics and you're facing a non-market competitor like China, you see enormous losses over the last several decades. And that is not just a China story. That is us making poor decisions. And what I think you've seen, you know, what the Biden team has tried to do is sort of, you know, shift. But shifting is hard, right? I mean, you're going up against, you know, 3 or 4 decades now of pushing in a different direction, right? And so I think what you're looking at is, you know, the first signs of real change, right? You're seeing, you know, real investment flowing back into manufacturing in this country. You know, the last time I checked, it's been a few weeks now, but it's almost up to $900 billion of private money flowing into American manufacturing. That number would have been unheard of just a few years ago, right?
Yeah. No, look, the bad policy, Ryan, has been on both sides. I'm not going to just point at Republicans or Democrats. They were both bad. I mean, you look at NAFTA. NAFTA was birthed under Reagan, fully negotiated under H.W. Bush and signed into law by Clinton. And, you know, very few people did anything on NAFTA until, well, Trump got something, not great, but something a little bit better. But still, we're still having problems.
Yeah, no question about it. I mean, like I said, this is not it's not a short-term thing. This has been going on for quite some time, and changing that narrative, changing that approach, I think is it takes some time. But it also, you know, you're pushing back against a lot of people that have done awfully well over the last, you know, 30 or 40 years. When you're looking at, you know, CEO pay is what, 400 times the average employee. You know, 40 years ago, it wasn't even close to that, right? So there are people that have done quite well, and they're not happy with some of the changes.
Yeah, what do you say to the argument? Because I've had a lot of my my Trump supporters say, well, you know, Trump's going to do away with individual taxes, and we're just going to, tariffs are going to cover everything. Have you heard this argument?
Yeah, I mean, Trump told, you know, his disciples, our Republican members of Congress, this, you know, a few weeks ago, that we're going to replace all of the income tax with tariffs. I mean, I think you need to start when you talk about that proposal, that it is mathematically impossible, right? So, you know, we can talk about kind of the theory behind it or the feeling behind it, but you actually can't replace our budget with simply tariffs. The income tax is a big part of it. But I think importantly, you know, just the idea, just thinking about the idea of replacing income taxes with tariffs means shifting the economic burden from, you know, middle and working class people who are going to pay more for stuff while cutting taxes on the very wealthy, right? I mean, that might sound great to Trump's, you know, country club buddies, but it certainly doesn't sound well to, you know, the folks that I certainly grew up alongside.
Yeah, but again, for me it is, you know, you get this, you give people this nugget, we're not gonna have to pay taxes anymore. And then this becomes the narrative instead of what you just said. It's just going to be a cost shifting, and it's going to be ended up being consumers who take it on the chin. So then let me ask you, you know, by having these tariffs, because again, this is an argument that I've had 1,000 times, you know, tariffs are going to raise the price of goods. It's going to make things a little bit more expensive. How do you get past that?
Well, I think you have to tell people kind of what the end goal is, right? I mean, people want to know what things are working towards, right? And so you start by saying, we want to make more things in this country, right? We want to make our economic security more secure, right? We want to make our national security more secure. We want to make our supply chains more resilient. We want to make sure that we're returning wealth and prosperity to the working class, right? So if you start with those goals, and then you can lay out kind of a policy agenda to get there, I think you have a much better kind of way of doing it. But you're right. I mean, this is a thing, right? I mean, if you do have, you know, certain tariffs in place, those tariffs are likely to raise the cost of certain imports. But you're doing it for a reason that people can, I think, get behind.
No, look, I was told, you know, again, this is going back 30 years when the whole China thing was going on, you're going to be able to have choice. And I love how conservatives always throw that choice out there. And you know, we know that it never seems to last. But I was told I was going to have an American-made product next to a Chinese product. And as a consumer in the free market, I could make my choice. Well, I got to tell you, I go into the stores. There doesn't seem to be the choice of any American-made product because I would be the first to buy them. Yes, I would pay more for an American-made product because I know my neighbor might have that job. I may have that job.
Yeah, no question about it. I mean, this is, you know, when you're talking about manufacturing, you're talking about, you know, not just a pathway to, say, middle class for millions of people, but also the foundation of real communities around the country, right? It's not just an individual thing, it's a community thing. And I think it's important to think in those terms.
Yeah, and I'll be honest, I give Trump credit for stealing Bernie Sanders' message and talking about reshoring manufacturing. I'll give him credit for that. He talked about it. Didn't do much in bringing manufacturing back. A lot of rhetoric, a lot of you know, weeks of infrastructure and manufacturing stuff. Nothing got done. But the issue is now front and center, and it's one of those things that people are finally are talking about and wanting again. So the question is, you know, going forward, and I know next week you guys have got a prescription for U.S.-China trade. You know, what is the way forward for folks like me, for you know, the Biden administration or whomever that's going to be? What is the way forward?
Well, I'll say a couple of things on that. I mean, on the first part about Trump, I think it's important to, you know that I think he talks about tariffs because his internal polling says that people hear that and they think that he's tough on China or that he's going to stand up for their job. And the reality is he hasn't. He was not tough on China. His sort of, you know, phase one trade deal delivered nothing, right? His trade wars delivered almost nothing. And that he certainly didn't create any new manufacturing jobs. So that link between sort of like talking big on tariffs and toughness, I think has to be cut because it's just not true. And then I think the way forward, I think is really interesting. I mean, I think anytime you come up with a new strategy, any strategist in anything, you come up with sort of like an offensive and defensive strategy, right? And for a long time, we've talked about China. We talk only about defense. right? What are the tariff levels going to be? What is the protection that you need? That's only part of it. And certainly it is an important part, but there's also the offensive agenda, right? How are we investing in our country again? How are we developing the next great sort of technology? How are we deploying new processes and new technologies and factory floors across the country? I think that linking of the two, offensive and defense, is kind of the way forward. And that's something that, you know, we talk a lot about here at CAP, but I'm sure others do as well.
No, I mean, all the things that we've invented over the years, I don't know, like solar panels, we should be the manufacturing hub of the globe, but we tend to develop things, you know, cell phones, and never make them here.
Yeah, no question. I mean, when the president ran 4 years ago, we talked about invent it here, make it here as sort of the agenda. And I'm a, you know, big supporter of that. I did some work on that when I was at the White House. I mean, the goal is to do both, right? We can both invent things and make things. And those things should be tied together to the extent possible.
So in looking at this campaign, the run up, I know you're not going to get into the political end of this, but where do you see the messaging on this? Because, look, I think people want Made in America. I think the administration, the Biden administration, has done a great job. My friend Celeste Drake has done a great job as the Made in America person. But, you know, how do we move that stuff forward? And what's the messaging that you see on both sides?
Yeah, I mean, I'll stay a little bit away from like political prognostication here. But I mean, to me, it feels like, you know, the Biden campaign has real numbers to kind of back up their argument, right? When you look at, you know, I think 800,000, you know, new manufacturing jobs since President Biden took office, you know, that's something you can really point to, right? When you're talking about new investment flowing into manufacturing for the first time in a very long time, certainly at the levels that it's flowing in, that's something you can point to and say, you know, these sort of policy prescriptions have worked and will continue to work. I think it's sort of incumbent on anybody running for office to not talk, though, about just what you've done, but what you want to do going forward. And I think, you know, there you're looking at, you know, what's the next iteration of, say, chips and science, right? Is, you know, semiconductors obviously hugely important. You know, what are we doing about AI? What are we doing about quantum? What are we doing about sort of biotech, right? There's a whole host of other sectors that will sort of, you know, lead the 21st century. How are we going to be the world leader in that? And then I think you're talking, too, about tailoring, updating, you know, kind of the tariff or protection that our industry needs to be able to compete against a non-market actor like China. You know, to be fair, I mean, you know, all of the trade tools that we talk about, you know, you can throw the 232, 301, whatever, they all date from the 60s and 70s, right? We are fighting a modern great power economic rivalry with China using Vietnam era tech.
Yeah.
How do we update that toolkit to be more relevant to what we need today?
So you would think, as I do, that this is, again, another failure of a broken Congress who can't seem to name post office, let alone deal with something this complicated. And that's a struggle for me.
Yeah, no question. I mean, it's a yet another example of, you know, what a broken Congress means, because it means you're not solving problems that are relevant to people's lives.
Because the reason I bring this up, and the reason I think it's so important, is, you know, Congress is broken because I think we're broken. And this is one of those issues that I think should bring us back together. The idea of manufacturing things at home, made in America, seems to be a winning slogan. People like it. They get behind it. But we don't seem to be voting for people who are actually doing it often. And I look at the difference between Trump and Biden. You got Trump, who talked about it nonstop, but Biden, who's actually doing it. So for me, I think it's going to come down to us as voters to have to do this. So last line of questioning I've got for you. You've got a series of virtual town halls, I guess. I guess this is your first one on July 15th at 11 a.m. Eastern time. You're talking about trade in the U.S. What can we expect on this panel that you're part of? What are you guys going to talk about?
Yeah, so CAP put out a report a few months ago, kind of looking at, you know, what a pragmatic, progressive, principled approach to dealing with China looks like, right? Because on the one hand, you have the kind of anti-China, everything about China is bad. And then you have, I think, you know, our approach where we say we have to take a hard, strong, principled approach to China, but China's not going anywhere, right? And like on some issues like climate, we need to actually work closely with China, right? So how do you sort of manage that relationship? And we put out a report that has a number of different topic areas, one of which is trade, of course. And so we're going to be talking more about that on Monday. Kim Glass will be joining as well. It should be a really interesting conversation. Yeah. And then over the next, you know, several weeks and months, you'll see, I think, more of these sort of town halls where we go kind of deeper onto a particular topic area.
No, I think it's great. I think the hour will be well spent. I'm looking forward to seeing the replay of it. But I hope folks will check it out, and we'll get links out on social media how people can do that. But Ryan, I appreciate you taking some time for us, sharing some thoughts. Great stuff.
Thanks, Rick. Appreciate it.
Ryan Mulholland, senior fellow there at the Center for American Progress. AmericanProgress.org, the website. I want to hear your thoughts. Is China your issue? Is it important this time around? I think jobs are kind of important. Email me, Rick at the RickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1850. That was the birthday of Oscar Niebuhr. Niebuhr was one of eight men convicted of inciting violence at a workers' rally at Haymarket Square in Chicago in 1886. He was born in New York City, where he became a skilled tinsmith. He moved to Chicago in 1877, where he worked at the Adams Westlake Manufacturing Company. He was fired and blacklisted when he tried to organize his fellow workers. This, however, did not stop his organizing efforts. Oscar founded his own business, the Acme Yeast Company, and turned his attention to organizing brewery workers. He was active in the Chicago Central Labor Union. By 1886, the labor movement was growing in power and action in Chicago. On May 1st, thousands took to the streets in strikes and demonstrations for the 8-hour workday. 3 days later, a bomb was thrown by an unknown assailant at a workers' rally protesting police violence against demonstrators. No one knows to this present day who threw the bomb. Eight men were tried and convicted for the crime. Oscar Niebuhr was sentenced to 15 years in prison in Joliet, Illinois. Four of his fellow accused were executed by the hangman's rope. After 6 years in prison, Niebuhr was pardoned by Illinois Governor John Peter Altgeld. His first wife died shortly after the trial. It is said she died of a broken heart. At his trial, Niebuhr wrote, quote, "I have been in the labor movement since 1875. I have seen how the police have trodden on the Constitution of this country and crushed the labor organizations. I am sorry I am not to be hung with the rest of the men." For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So, you know, I got to tell you, I think, you know, Ryan's right. You know, got to have a plan. Simple. And this is what we've been talking about Trump for a long time. Look, I give Trump credit for having his thumb somewhere near a pulse. Someone's telling him what's going on. The fact that we've had bad trade deals for years, you know, look, I said he stole that from Bernie Sanders. Had Sanders been the nominee in 16, I think we have a President Sanders, because that was the important issue of the day. Trade was it. Manufacturing was it. I think it can be this election as well. It's just that we're hung up on, well, one, trying to figure out who the Democrats are going to have as their nominee. I know a lot of my friends are on the side of, we got to stick with Joe. A lot of friends like me going, I saw what I saw on Thursday night. The hope. Joe does what's in the best interest of the country. Now, look, this trade thing, this next administration is going to have to continue to work on, going to have to eventually get it right. And I think Joe Biden has been transformational in this. And I've been saying this all along, picked up what Donald Trump talked about and actually went out and did some stuff. We're reshoring manufacturing. We are doing that. We are investing in our infrastructure and put a Buy American provision in that so that we have to produce that stuff here. That, and it sounds so simple, but that's transformational. And I look at the fact that we're going to have to figure out how to deal with China on a global scale. This isn't just a U.S. problem. This is a global problem. This is figuring out how, you know, the rest of the world has an economy that China is trying to swallow up. and you go, well, you know, we need to do that through negotiations and diplomacy, and I'm all in favor of negotiations and diplomacy, but what do you do when that doesn't work? Because we've been doing diplomacy and negotiations, well, from the beginning. And China goes, oh, yeah, you're right. Oh, yeah, yeah, we'll do better. And then they continue doing what they've been doing, which is absorbing our entire manufacturing economy. Like I said, we didn't lose manufacturing. We know exactly where it is. We gave it away through bad policy and greedy CEOs. Let's not let them off the hook. When all these companies ran overseas because, hey, cheap exploitable labor, mass subsidies, oh boy. And then complaining, well, they're stealing our intellectual property. Well, of course, because you're dumb enough to give it to them. But for me, there's the nice stuff. Let's talk. Okay, I'm willing to talk. But at a certain point, you got to get the stick out. And that's where tariffs and trade barriers come up. And I know. But Rick, we're addicted to cheap stuff. And we are. Because the first time the prices go up, you're going to hear Americans squeal. Look at what's going on right now. And the thing that bothers me, and I've talked about this, you know, for a very long time. Yeah, prices have gone up. How are we reacting? We're reacting by complaining. Have you said we're just not going to buy this stuff and it's going to sit there? No, we're Americans. We don't do that. Have we complained that our wages haven't kept up? Evidently, no. We have not as much as I would like to see. So it's all going to complain about, you know, the prices are too high. And who do we blame? We blame Biden. And I'm going, how do you drive that car to that location? How do you get there? Well, you know, he stopped the Keystone XL pipeline. You mean that oil that was never going to come to the U.S.? The oil, that dirty tar sands oil that they had to refine somewhere else in the world because we don't have the capacity to do it here. You mean that? That was going to save us? That was going to make things easier? Well, the Keystone Pipeline, they shut it down. No. Keystone Pipeline is working just fine. There's lots of oil flowing through that. It's the XL part. It was that expansion, you know, over one of the largest freshwater supplies in the world. Yeah, that. That again, oil that was never going to come here. But that was it? Yeah, that was it. And you go, well, you know, I've seen many reports that say, you know, corporate greed had a big part of this. If you paid attention to the earnings calls, you'd have seen that. And this is where I come back to, where there's a moment here in this country where we can have a national vision where we create an economy that's good for everybody. We have jobs for people at every skill level, every interest level, every educational level, because you need a wide array of employment to have a functional society. Because I know I'm old school on this. I still believe that there is therapeutic quality to work, that we need jobs. We need to make stuff. We need to invent things. We need to be constantly pushing. But our trade policies have just been terrible. And we need to do a lot more investing in the jobs of tomorrow. We need to be doing a lot more investing in education. We need to be doing a lot more that my friends would call socialist. You know, using money in a much better way than the private sector. Because understand, the private sector, they use funds to enrich themselves. They're smart. They know what to do with the money. Make more money for themselves. When the public invests money, it's in the public interest. It's for the public good. I know we haven't talked like this for generations. It's almost heresy. But the idea that the public sector can spend money in a better way than the private sector is not something you're going to hear very often. But it's something we should be talking about. And this is an opportunity for me, I think, for the Biden folks or whoever the Democrat is, to go, look, we can build a great future. We can have manufacturing. We can have education. We can have health care. We just need to demand it. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Can you see the future? Can you see that utopia? Well, it's not utopia. It's what my grandparents grew up with. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At Rick at thericksmithshow.com.
You're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK Amory and 107.5 FM W298 DK Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.